The Round Golf Podcast with Richard Kaufman.
Hi again, thanks for joining us on the Round Golf Podcast, brought to you by Navigate Contracting and Red Ray. This week, a golfer who, by his own admission, doesn't live by the book, doesn't live by the rules, Nicholas Coulthard, a player who said he needed to get the rock and roll lifestyle out of his system. And he says he doesn't regret his story because at least he's got a story to tell, and I was very fortunate that he told it to me. There are some twists and turns along the way, the teenage highs to the lows in his 20s, and then the talent fulfilled as he becomes a man on a mission that leads to a week that he will cherish for the rest of his life, talking about the Ryder Cup, the miracle at Medina, and what a part he had to play as well. He says at the start of this interview, it wasn't a difficult choice to make as far as choosing the round.
Because it's the Ryder Cup, because it's something that means a lot or has meant a lot to me for a long time. I've always wanted to play in one. I was lucky enough to see two when I was only a junior golfer, and I always made a point in my career to be able to play in one. So being able to play that well on a day where the European Tour was not doing that great, to be the only rookie to pull off such an amazing round was something pretty special.
Just go back a little bit. The day that you found out, because you didn't qualify for the Ryder Cup, you were a pick, weren't you?
Yep.
So that day when you found out you were going to be playing in the Ryder Cup, was that also a significant day?
Yeah, I mean, I felt like I had a pretty big chance to make the team, to get picked. I felt like I've done everything that I could have done to make myself available. Nobody around me in the standings had gone the extra mile, posted something significant in the last couple of weeks of qualifying to kind of outchoice me, I'd say. And yeah, it was, when you get the green light, it's a little weight off your shoulders because you know you've made it, but you know that, you know, coming in a couple of weeks' time, I mean, you're going to be asked a lot.
Jose Mario Alathaba was the captain. So did he call you up?
Well, I was, so the last qualifying tournament was at Glen Eagles, where we played
Johnny Walker.
And I have friends that live in Ochterada nearby, which I was going to stay stunned Sunday night anyway. I told the people in charge that I was going to stay there Sunday in case they needed to see me, or because I knew the press conference was going to be the next day. And I got a call, I think about maybe 10 o'clock at night, from Olazabal, who asked where I was, and I told him I was only 15 minutes drive away, and he asked to see me. So I hopped in the car, went to Glen Eagles, got to the hotel, and Jimmy Spence was there to welcome me. And
sorry, I don't want to interrupt, but
no.
So Jose didn't say what the news was.
No, he just said he wanted to talk to me. He asked where I was, and I said I was nearby. So you
didn't ask?
No, I didn't ask then. I mean, I knew that he wasn't going to say he wasn't going to tell me on the phone anyway.
Right.
So I hopped in the car, got to the hotel. Jamie Spence was there to welcome me into the hotel, and he started like giving me this small chit chat, and I was like, I'm going to stop you right there. Like, stop being nice. Just take me where I need to go, and let me hear him from the main guy.
So you went to, what was it, in a hotel room?
Or? Yeah, they were into this suite in Glen Eagles Hotel. They were watching the golf because they were obviously still looking at a few guys over in the US. I think Patrick was one of them. Paul Casey was one of them. And none of them was really making or doing anything that week. So I walked into the room and there was a few guys from the Ryder Cup committee. And of course, Olazabal was there with his famous agent. And they were just having food, watching the golf. And sat down, and he looked at me, and by the way he looked at me, I kind of figured it was going to be good, but you know, I still had to hear from him.
So you're the first Belgian to be picked and to play in a Ryder Cup. Obviously, when we get to that first morning that you played with Lee Westwood, did that have a significance for you, being the first from your country?
Yes, a little bit. I mean, it wasn't, I never wanted to get into the Ryder Cup team for Belgium to have a Belgian player in. I mean, I wanted to do it for myself, or just to be part of such an unbelievable experience. Of course, it over time it has, you know, brought golf on the map a little better. And of course, in 2 years after, you know, Thomas Peters did exactly the same thing. So the both of us have somehow tried our best to put golf in a better position in people's minds, in the press back home. Whether we did it or not, that's another question. But I mean, we did what we felt we had to be done.
So you heard the words you wanted to hear. You're now part of the team. How much of a whirlwind was it then?
Well, it was at first it was big excitement, joy, and slowly kind of realizing that I was going to be part of it. And of course, images came by of the two Ryder Cups that I've been to.
So which Ryder Cups had you been to?
I went to Valderrama in 97, and I went to Brookline in 99.
Was that part of the junior Ryder Cup?
Yeah, I played in both. And of course, I had seen both sides. The European team winning in 97 with Seve as a captain. Westwood was a rookie. Thomas Bjorn was there. Faldo, Monty, I mean, like all these guys that I basically watched growing up, and then in 99 with the abuse from the crowd, the story with Monty, the situation on 17th green with Justin Leonard. I mean, so I got to see really a fantastic edition where a European had won and a controversial one where the Americans won on home soil.
So you felt fairly prepared as you could be.
Well, I don't think there is such a thing as being prepared for one, because it's indescribable. What's it like to be in that environment, and especially in the US, that hostile kind of vibe that you get some editions, not all of them, but some editions, and the latest ones have proven to be exactly the same. But it's very difficult to prepare. Yeah, it doesn't matter if you go to one from outside the ropes, you don't really understand how much goes through the players' minds. What's it like to feel the atmosphere, depending on how much you want it. But I've always wanted to be part of this. I've always wanted to make a contribution. So when you're thrown into an arena like this, that's pretty vile. You either react very well, or you can see it as something that shocks you and sometimes get kind of thrown off by it.
So you were rested for the morning foursome. Did you know, though, that while that was going on, that you would definitely be playing in the four balls in the afternoon?
Yeah, it was pretty clear that I wasn't going to play in the foursomes right away as a rookie. My game is not really a foursome type game. I mean, I always tend to think I would be more efficient playing four balls anyway. So it was quite clear that I was going to be watching what happens in the morning, get a feel for it, get a feel for the first tee, which is very important. The first time you play is go and see the couple of shots that are being played out of the first tee, because it's an atmosphere like nowhere else in golf. And it was actually a very good thing for me to go and see some of the shots that were played by the best players in the world out of the first tee, because then it kind of made me think that I was allowed to hit a disgusting one off the first, after seeing some shots that had been played by the best in the morning.
Sure. So let's go to that afternoon, Friday afternoon. You're playing the four balls. You obviously knew who your partner was going to be, but you didn't know who you're going to be playing.
Well, the first thing is I asked to play with Lee. I mean, I felt like he was going to be the person I would have been the most comfortable to be with in my first game anyway. So it was kind of my request after, not a debate, but I kind of had to push for it a little bit. So I ended up having the partner that I wanted. And then the draw comes out and we're playing Tiger and Stricker. And funny enough, I mean, I'm not saying it took pressure off my shoulders, but I didn't want to play somebody that was red hot like Keegan with Phil, because they seem to have an unbelievable partnership they've proven that week. But I felt like, okay, you lose to Stricker in Woods, you lose to Stricker in Woods. I mean, nobody's going to, give you any stick for it.
So like a no-lose situation,
well,
really?
It's not really like a no-lose situation, because you never want to lose. But I felt like, okay, well, it is what it is. I have a fantastic partner in Westwood. If I can come in a couple of times during the game and maybe push it as far as possible, and we will see how it goes. But I felt like I didn't really see the opposition as being like, oh my God, this is going to be a mountain that I'm never going to be able to get over.
So this is the 2012 Ryder Cup. This is in Medina. First tee, who chose for you to go first?
I have a little chat with Westy on the putting green, and I'm like, how do we do this? You go out first or I do? He's like, I'll go first if you want. And I look at him and went, you know, fuck it, I'll go first, get it over with. And so I teed it up first, closed my eyes, everything was shaking, saw the ball blur, and flew a trap that was maybe 300 yards with a 3-wood, and was still shaking 10 minutes after the opening tee shot.
So did you close your eyes while hitting?
Well, no, I didn't close my eyes, but I mean, as soon as I came back from my last look down the fairway over the ball, my knees starting to shake, my hands starting to shake, I'm starting to see the ball blur, and I remember telling myself that, well, you wanted to be here, you're going to have to go, you can't back off now. So I basically pulled the trigger and was kind of like hoping to make contact.
And how long before those kind of nerves disappeared? Did it immediately?
No, they kept going till the first green, where I had a 20-footer up the hill, and I had this putt, and as soon as it left the putter face, I thought like, this might be just short, and it shaved the front edge of the hole. Like, remember, these greens are rolling 13 on the stimp, so as soon as I saw that ball die just in front of the hole, I walked over to Lee and I told him, it's funny, I'm still shaking from the first tee, but I feel like my senses are there. And next thing you know, I birdied the second, I almost made birdie on the third, hold a 40-footer on the fourth, made birdie on the fifth, missed a very makeable one on six, made birdie on seventh. I mean, it was just amazing to like snowball from the second green onwards.
When did you realize what was happening? Was it a blur? Did it just feel normal?
Well, it did feel normal to me because I was doing everything that I was seeing. Of course, when you started making putts from everywhere, you kind of somehow realize what you're doing. But I was so into the game, and I realized pretty quickly that whatever we were going to do, it's four balls. You never really run away from the opposition if the opposition makes a few birdies here and there. So it was never going to be, you know, a 5-4 or a 6-5, and it kept going. You know, where we're going, you know, birdies after another. I mean, I never really knew what was, you know, the score combined for both teams, but I mean, it was loads of birdie in that game.
Because you were a birdie machine. We know you broke the records that day for birdies by a rookie, but it wasn't like, as you say, you were completely dominating the pair of Stricker and Woods.
No, I think at best we were like two up, and I made 8 birdies and an eagle. So I mean, it was quite a pretty tight game. Yeah.
Yeah. That putt on 17. I mean, was that the moment?
Well, yeah, there was a good one on 15 first, but the one on 17 is, I mean, after Tiger hit it to, I don't know, 4 feet, and I remember walking over the bridge and seeing Tiger was pretty close, and kind of figured pretty quickly he was going to make two when we were only one up, and he had just holed a 30-footer on 16. So I mean, they're coming back, and as soon as I stepped on the green on 17, I completely forgot, you know, what the other side was going to do, and I just had a decent, well, I guess I had a decent read on what my putt was going to do, but I completely forgot what, you know, the intensity of the meaning of the moment. I was just really into what I needed to do.
Is that normal for you? Because there are thousands around this green. You said you'd seen Tiger knock it to so many feet, few feet away. You know that potentially you're going to be going all square down the 18th in what is a moment you've worked towards for such a long time, to be playing at a Ryder Cup first match. You've been playing so well, yet potentially it might not end in a victory, yet you said you were...
I didn't, yeah. I only realized how many persons were at the back of the green after I hold it, when I, you know, where I kind of walked towards them and showed them that I made a two. But, and it's funny because during the day, I told myself, as much hostility as there is outside the ropes, the only thing I got to worry about is these four balls. Anything else is irrelevant. You know, whatever I would do, or Lee was doing, or the American team was doing, those were the only things that I needed to worry about or to know what's going on. The rest, I could just, it didn't really have any importance to me.
You mentioned the hostility. Well, how far would that go?
It was pretty easy for me because they didn't have anything on me. They didn't really know me much. I never really had a big, you know, history in the US, so they weren't really that bad against me. There's a few things that comes out of karate in there, but you know, when you play with Westwood, or you play with Sergio, or you play with somebody that had, you know, has baggage or history in the US. I mean, they're a bit more direct and a bit more personal, but they didn't have anything against me. I only realized that the next day playing with Sergio in the foursomes.
So going back to that part at 17, I mean, quite rightly, there you are, knocking in this putt to make sure the Americans can't get back to a square. You lapped that up. I mean, that was that the moment that sort of encapsulates the day, maybe encapsulates the Ryder Cup of that year for you?
It's funny because I'm never really somebody that fist bumps and stuff like that. I mean, I was never really into that, or when I do it, it's very unconsciously. And two times during that round, I ended up fist bumping and shouting without realizing that I did. I hold a birdie putt on 13, I think, the par 3, and that's the first reaction from mine that was not really me, just because you get taken by the environment. And one on 17 is just exactly the same. I mean, if you look at the images, you can clearly see that there's an outburst of not anger, but like if you look at the images, you clearly understand.
Yeah, sure. I mean, it was an emotional moment for you.
Well, no, emotional is different. I mean, emotional sounds like, you know, you're gonna shed a tear, but it's not anger is not quite a word. I mean, I'm trying to find a better word in English.
And of course, it meant that going down 18, you were one up and only needed the half. What's Lee saying to you now at this point?
Well, it's funny because we both hit it down the fairway, and I mean, I've been basically carrying this game on my shoulders for 4.5 hours. I mean, I did more than was asked from my part, and Westwood's got an 8-iron into the green, a left pin, plenty of green to the right, and he flares this 8-iron right out of the green, and I'm like, shit, I mean, I still got work to do. I mean, like, how can you leave this young guy that's probably on his knees, like he's like exhausted from carrying everything, and I still had to concentrate a little bit at the end and hit just a standard shot down the green and still give myself maybe a 25-30 footer, and I had enough. I just lagged it and was hoping for the best, and Woods still had maybe a 15 footer to have the game, and when I lagged my putt up, I picked it up and went stand by the side of green with Westy, and I told him I don't know if I have the courage to watch this, and he looked at me with a smile and said, might as well watch it. And next thing you know, Woods blipped out and won the point basically on my own.
Fantastic feeling. Did you know how big a deal it was?
Well, I only realized how much it meant when I saw a couple of teammates coming up to me and the expression on their faces. Because, I mean, most of them, I'm sure, knew how well I could play, but to see someone that from, you know, at the beginning of the build-up of this Ryder Cup was the only rookie, and there's a rookie, there's only one rookie, and who is he, and all that kind of stuff, and to be able to deliver like that, I'm sure some of them were quite happy that, first for the team, but quite happy for me to be able to live, because most of them had lived moments like this, but when you get to do it on your first day, I mean, it's something very special.
There's always a talk about how it's hard to follow up a really low round the next day with another good round. That must have been such a high, but obviously there was a job to be done to try and win the cup. How hard was it to not just live off that and concentrate on what was coming up?
Well, there was a lot. There was, you know, two more days of play. We were behind. You know, it's not like we were up by a few points and, yeah, maybe you would have taken it a little bit more easily, but, you know, we were behind. I was in a foursomes with Sergio against Zach Johnson and Jason Duffner. I mean, it's, you know, decent opposition. So it's not like it was time to party yet.
I meant from a perspective that, you know, you've performed this first time anyone's ever done anything like this as a rookie.
Yeah.
To go out the next day and it, you know, you can't hold 40 footers every day. The golf must have felt really ordinary, and it must have been hard to get that buzz.
Well, I mean,
that
it's foursome, it's a different format. I was playing with Sergio that I had never played with before, even in a normal stroke play event. So we're basically exchanging, you know, golfer's DNA in the car going to the golf course in the morning.
So why were you paired together?
I don't know.
Jose Maria's choice, obviously.
Well, maybe not just his, but, you know, maybe after sitting with the others, they felt that with the way I played and the way I had been playing for months, that I was maybe I was going to be, you know, a good horse to bet on in Fossum as well. But next thing you know, we're standing on the 17th tee, we're one down. Sergio just holds a chip. I hit a fantastic 6-iron straight at the pin on 16. He holds the chip from the back edge to go about one down, and 17, I hit my tee shot in the water. Game over. To answer your question, you come from an unbelievable high of beating Tiger and Stricker in foursomes on your own, to feeling like you've threw the game away by hitting a tee shot on a par three in a water.
There's so much I want to ask you about yourself and your career and your life. It's hard to move away from this Ryder Cup, but I want to. But just to quickly encapsulate, you singles, you were the first man out, were you? Or the
no.
First match to finish on the Sunday?
No. I was number six in the lineup, and I was the first one to lose.
Ah, that's right, yeah.
Yeah, thanks for reminding me.
Sorry. I've got a bit
who
of
cares, we won. Who cares, we won.
Just on that though, so you're the first from the team to lose. It was a day of one of the all-time comebacks in sport, never mind in golf. You say you didn't care, you just were...
Well, you don't care at the end, but as soon as I lost my game, I'm being interviewed by the BBC and one question fine, two question fine, and then I burst into tears. Just knowing that the week was over, well, not yet, but my week was over, or I couldn't make any more contribution, I felt... You know, so sad that I hadn't did any better in the singles, because I was all square with I think four to play or all square with five to play, and I lost 3-2. So it went from I can push this till the end, or I have a decent chance at this, to within three holes, you know, losing to Dustin Johnson. It went very quickly, and it was a bit hard to take.
And now you're just a spectator, cheering on the rest of the guys.
Yeah, I always will be. I always was.
Sure.
And always will be, of course, yeah.
But ultimately, it's such a positive memory because of the way it all turned out.
Yeah, you know, it's a week that I will cherish for the rest of my life, of course, for many reasons. Not just the emotions that you feel during that week, but the way it was done, the way we won. Seeing guys that you see week in, week out on from such a different angle, when you throw them into a team environment, you know, all trying to do the same thing and trying to put the teammates in the best environment possible.
I know what your best memory is from playing, in terms of that match with Lee.
Mm.
Of the night after,
yeah.
What was the best memory for you from what happened post-victory?
The funniest thing was, at the press conference, Westwood always had two drinks in his hand, and I didn't have any. He looked at me and went, "See, Nick, this is what seven Ryder Cup experience look like, and look at you, your first one, you have no drink in your hand."
Let's go back then, because you're from a very sporting family,
yeah,
aren't you? I mean, it's...
Well, my father's side is, yeah.
Yeah, so your dad, your grandfather?
Yeah, a great-grandfather, grandfather, father.
So your great-grandfather, what did he do?
My great-grandfather played water polo and basketball, represented Belgium in the Olympics, one of the founders of the Basketball Federation in Belgium, early century, and then grandfather played a lot of hockey. Dad played first division hockey in Belgium for 25 years, and I played a lot of tennis when I was young, squash, anything, racket with a ball.
So with that history, as you say, for your dad's side, sport was obviously a big part of family life.
Oh, it was sport was life. I never was interested in anything else. As soon as I'd come out of school, the only thing I thought about, and even at school, to be fair, maybe 80% of the time, was just looking out the window thinking what it was doing in there.
You went to an interesting school though, didn't you?
Yeah, I went to normal schools till I was 15, and then I went to a very strange way of schooling, which was a guy that had been the tutor of one of the Belgian princes, and it was only 20, 30 students in the school. You could basically learn anything with him, all the basic stuff, and then you could have Greek lessons, Russian lessons, Japanese lessons. He would sometimes take us in his car. He would choose five or six guys, take us in his car, go around Brussels and give us a history tour of Brussels. So a very different way of studying, but it made a huge difference in my education, because I started to have a pretty good general knowledge about everything, became very, you know, pretty good street smart, and it helped me a lot because I was basically traveling on my own since I was 15, and been able to travel the world with that baggage that guy kind of teach me was very, very important.
So you think it helped in terms of what came as a professional golfer? Because at this age of 15, I take it now golf was going to be your life already?
Or? Yeah, of course. I mean, I knew pretty quickly it was going to be what my life was going to be like, or I would evolve around that environment. But it certainly helped me to travel in a much easier way. Knew what was the world like. If I had stayed into the normal system, you know, you basically go by the book, and I would have never traveled as easily as I did if I had stayed in the normal schooling system.
It's interesting you bring up that expression, go by the book, because I don't know you very well, I know of you, but going by the book is something I don't think is something you live by.
No, it's not something I've always been a fan of. But then again, the choices of schools I went to when I was young, I mean, I always felt, or I realized quite quickly I was different, just because what I was into, seeing what the other guys or girls were doing, or the stuff that they laughed about, or the stuff that they were watching, and I not like I felt like I was an outcast, but I knew quite quickly I was different, and I'd had to find my own way of doing things.
18 is when you turn pro. That was quite early. You mentioned already the Junior Ryder Cup, so you've been around obviously at a very good amateur level. 18 though, you obviously felt ready to turn pro. It's quite young.
I didn't really know what I was getting myself into. I mean, I knew that it was what I wanted to do, but the first time I went to Q school, I went to Q school without really knowing the consequences. You know, within a couple of weeks, I would be teeing it up in South Africa in my first pro event. If you had sent a TV crew with me the first couple of weeks on tour, I mean, it would have been an unbelievable sitcom.
Go on.
Well, it took us 5 holes to realize that Johannesburg was at more than 1,000 meter altitude.
So you kept on wondering why you were flying
the
green.
We flew the first 5 greens by 20. We didn't really think that. Well, it was.
Who was with you?
My coach was with me, but he was, as much as he had worked a little bit with Florence Descamps back in the day when she was working with Ledbetter and all that. You know, the men's tour was something that we had no idea about.
So this is back in 2000. Literally, you finished fifth at Q school a few days after you turned 18. And there you are now, a couple of months later.
I turned pro on my 18th birthday, which was 2 days before the first round of Q school. And next thing you know, I'm leading after 4 rounds. 2 weeks later, or 3 weeks later, I'm teeing up in South Africa. The week after, I took Mick Darn on the bag that had unbelievable success with Lee Westwood. Finished second at the Open with Costantino Rocca, and I mean, here I am playing amateur events a couple of months before to having a very successful caddy on the bag that I'm 18. I'm my English wasn't as good as it is now. It was just a different world, and the shock from trying to bring my good golf from amateur days to the professional world was it was never going to work. When you look at the guys now, you know, they're so much more prepared than I was. You know, we never really had any help in Belgium. I mean, I'd only played 2 or 3 events on tour when I was an amateur, but just like really taking a holiday. You know, keep in mind that when I won my card at 18, I was then the second youngest in history to win a card. Now you're 18, 19, okay, you decide not to go to college in America, you go on tour. It doesn't really hit people as much as it did back then.
So that first season you struggled. Do you think it had a negative impact being a pro and winning your card early? In hindsight, maybe you'd have been better off playing Challenge Tour?
Who knows?
No.
Who knows? I mean, like, so the first year goes by, I lose my card, I go work in a restaurant for 3 months. I didn't touch a golf club for, I think, 2 months or 3 months.
What, because you were so upset?
Yeah, no, because I didn't want to hear about golf anymore. I mean, I, I was missing every cut. I think I only made 50 grand a year or something like that. I finished 180th on the European Tour. Went to PQ2 and decided not to play the last round because I had enough. I just wanted to do something different. And after not playing golf for 3 months, Jos van Stiepel calls me up and he's like, "Do you want to go and play nine holes with this other guy?" And I hadn't touched a club for 3 months, and shows up. I show up and shot 4 under on nine holes. So I was like, "Okay, let's maybe take the dust off the clubs and bring him out again."
But you kept going back to Q School
that year. Then in 2002, I was lucky enough to just have a card on Challenge Tour, finished 7th, then got back on tour. 2003, couple of years, till 2007, then 2008-09 was playing third division events in France or wherever they wanted me.
So you're describing a life of not a professional golfer with success.
Up and down, yeah, of up and down, yeah.
But not with, I mean, obviously 7th on the Challenge Tour, I'm not dismissing it, but
no.
From Junior Ryder Cup, 18 years, get your card, suddenly not maybe stagnated, is that a fair word to use?
No, regressing.
Regressing.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah, of course, yeah. You go from being a young prospect, you know, signed by AMG and sold to this and that and how good he's going to be and all that kind of stuff, to, you know, being a 19, 20-year-old out on tour that didn't really understand the meaning of what professional golf was like or what needed to be done to somehow fulfill your potential.
Those years, were they also years where you had it to escape from obviously what was not a pretty sight on the golf course of what you want to achieve? Did you let that out then in terms of your social life, because you're a young guy now traveling Europe?
Yeah, it was all under control till 2007, 2008, 2009.
And then it got out of control.
No. It was out of control then. 2007 and 8, I was playing like small events, and I felt like I wasn't going anywhere, and did a lot of nightclubbing, went out a lot, but I had a lot of fun doing it. I mean, I always kind of felt that I had that side in me, that kind of rock and roll attitude, and then by the end of 2000s, I got helped by a French guy called Daniel Béchu, who told me, "Why don't you go to Australia? I take these young French dudes to this training camp in Australia for the winter. You come and have a look and see how long you want to stay. But I think it might be good for me." And I went, stayed there 3-4 months the first time. Came back, went on the Challenge Tour, and finished 3rd.
Just those days of golf secondary, let's put it that way. You did some DJing?
No. I always had a passion for music. I used to go to stores. I was always close to a lot of DJs in Brussels. I was on the scene, yeah. I mean, I knew where you needed to go.
How much were you practicing then, golf?
I don't know.
At all?
I don't even remember. Yeah, I would go to, I mean, like, it never really gave me a buzz to go and practice in Belgium in you know, the places that we have in Belgium. I mean, when you had a taste of playing great courses and practicing fantastic places, and all of a sudden you find yourself playing third division tournaments in France, not to minimize, you know, the potential that these tours have, but I felt so out of place. I was like, what is going on? Who am I? What does my life look like? Where am I going? Just these questions that everybody asks themselves at one stage in their lives.
Sure. But it's interesting, though, that you're from this family of professional sportsmen, you know, going back 100 years.
Yeah.
Your dad was a professional hockey player.
Well, there was no such thing as professional hockey then, but he was
professional, like,
yeah.
So he was dedicated to his sport. Yeah. What was he saying to you?
I think it was very difficult for him because he always wanted to be very successful at his sport. He's always taking his sport seriously, and he sees his son, who's, you know, over talented, not being able to get anything out of it because of a mix of his behavior, lack of of identity or team environment or what needed to be put in place for me to be able to go out and play golf and make a living. I think he must have had a couple of difficult years.
Yeah. You obviously didn't get anything from him, though, in terms of that unhappiness, or did you just ignore it? Because you said you were having a good time. Was there not that guilt?
Like I said, with this rock and roll thing, I felt like I had to finish the loop. You know, it was like a cycle that I had to go through, and whatever you people will believe me or not, I mean, I felt like I needed to live that life to be able to live the one after. Everybody wants to do things, and that was one of the things that I wanted to do. Okay, maybe it jeopardized, or it could end up disastrously, or you know, I could end up never playing on tour again ever in my life. But I knew I had it in me. I kind of had to do it.
It's interesting because in hindsight, as you say, it worked out fantastically well. We started this.
Thank God it did. Yeah.
Conversation with the Ryder Cup and what you achieved there, and obviously what you obviously had to achieve to get there. But you seemed like you knew that road was coming almost.
Well, I mean, I always felt like I had the capacity to do it and the disposition to do it. I was, maybe, playing with luck or playing with fire a little bit. But I mean, I've said this before, I don't regret my story whatsoever, because at least I have a story to tell. When you look at a lot of characters in golf now, I mean, I feel sad for some of these guys that haven't really lived or they, you can see sometimes or hear conversations and you're like, listen, dude, you're 24. Do you know anything else but golf? I mean, I feel that's kind of sad.
Yeah, there's a lot of one-dimensional.
There is. I mean, but look how big golf has become. I mean, and the competition is of course a lot tougher than it used to be. So then the equipment has made a lot of non-talented people being able to have unbelievable careers. But that's another discussion.
Well, just on that. Well, as you brought it up, it kind of hurt you a little bit, hasn't it? Because you've said it yourself, you were super talented, you are super talented. You can shape balls and hit balls, which some other golfers can't do, but the equipment kind of negates that talent a little bit.
I don't think a lot of guys cannot do it. It's just that that's not the way they play. You know, if you look at guys just beating up balls on the range just straight all the time, that's what golf has become. You don't really see a lot of guys except for Bubba and of course a lot of the top guys, they can move the ball depending on the elements and do this and do that. But you would have guys that would never be able to play certain type courses or certain type conditions because they don't that's not how they learn to play. I think I've come right at the right time learning to play with the old clubs, the old balls. Learned the golf that way because it kind of triggered not the artistry but the imagination of seeing what needed to be done to now the modern equipment where you can still do it, but it's not as easy. I'm not saying I'm playing as fantasy like as we all used to. I mean, all the guys from my generation can tell you the same, but you still have that flair. I mean, if you grew up into that era, it's basically in your DNA.
Going back to Australia then, you were obviously ready for that shift, I assume, by the fact that you decided you'd go there.
Well, I mean, I realized when I got there that this was going to do me a whole lot of good. Get out of that party scene in Belgium, get out of all that shit, and start off fresh. And next thing you know, I play on the Challenge Tour the year after and played okay in Morocco the first one. And then I had a stretch of 3 weeks where I drove from Belgium, 800 Ks down to France, from there, 1200 Ks to Italy. And I remember leaving from France, I finished 10th. And I remember I was ecstatic in the car. I just finished 10th on the Challenge Tour, or an event on the Challenge Tour. And I felt like I just won a major. So that's how far I was.
Was that the happiest you'd been to that point after tournament?
Yeah, because of golf, yeah. It would have been without that, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, those years, 2009, 10, 11, 12, it was just this upward curve.
Yeah, well, 2010 was kind of like going back on tour for the first time after 3-4 years, maybe. So I think a lot of guys kind of saw me coming and saw a different me, you know, being a lot more serious or managing my time a lot better than I did in the past. You know, before that, I was basically one of the first ones to put my hand up to have a good time. But when I came back in, after 2010, I still enjoyed myself quite a lot, but I was able to know exactly what needed to be done and when I could, you know, go out and have fun.
Yeah, because you by now 10 years older and wiser than the kid that came on tour for the first time. So that's
I had lived different lives already. I mean, I had lived as an 18-year-old on tour, thrown into an environment he wasn't able to cope with, to a very dark age, a very dark couple of years, and had time to think about, you know, who I was and what I wanted to do, and if there was a time to do it, it was going to be now. So I was on a mission.
And it kind of went. So 2010, you kind of established yourself as a European tour player, and then 2011, you get your first win.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, 2010 was pretty nice because it was kind of, you know, building one little thing after another. I felt like I was doing the right things, adding people in my team, or kind of had, you know, advices from different angles and stuff that I'd never thought that it was going to have such a big impact. Then 2011 kept going the same way, won in China, then went and played match play, which was one of the first very big exclusive event that I ever got to play, and went into the semis, lost in the semis to Poulter, where I felt like I had my hands on that semifinal. And then the next year got into the same event and ended up flying the week and had beaten the best players in the world.
Yeah, so I've got them written down here. You beat Graham McDowell in the final. On the way, you beat Justin Rose, Charles Schwartzel, Brant Snedeker and Paul Laurie. I mean, you know, we talk about going to the Ryder Cup and obviously knowing whether you can survive at that kind of level of intensity and pressure, but look what you did there.
Well, I think a lot of guys then kind of realized, like, fuck, this guy's good.
You knew this, obviously.
Already. No, but I felt like I was just, it all fell into places for me. That was what I was capable of doing, but I never really thought like, oh wow, I'm exceeding my expectations, because that's what I always thought that I was capable of doing. So yes, along the way, it's, you know, there's pretty decent hunting trophies on there, but when I played those games, I mean, not at any stage I was intimidated by any of them.
You were leading at the US Open.
I was leading at the US Open on Saturday, 2 years running.
Yeah. So it's just interesting that you kind of felt like it was the norm. Other people were kind of, oh, this guy can play.
Well, I said earlier, I was an outcast, so yeah. I guess I probably still was a little bit.
So obviously then the Ryder Cup happened, and we, you know, obviously we've discussed that. Then the lure of the PGA Tour comes along.
Oh, yeah, I forgot about that. I've got a decent story when you think about it.
Yeah. Well, why do you think I wanted to talk to you, Nicholas?
Yeah. Yeah, so then I got the chance to go and play in the US. I mean, I racked up enough points to get my card over there. And whether it was too early or not, that's another question.
Why would you say it's too early? Because we've just discussed how, you know, you've...
Well, because, I mean, I had kind of established myself on tour. You know, had won 2 years running. I'd finished, I think, 11th on the order of merit. I had played decent at a couple of events in the US. And then we just jumped right in it. Looking back, maybe should I have stayed in Europe one more year and kept doing what I was doing, because that seemed to be working quite well. And there was, you know, it's not because you win once, you win two times in 2 years, that, you know, maybe try to win two times in one season or keep going in that trend. And then when I discovered the tour in the US fully, not like the tournaments in the US was something I didn't know, but to play different events, to go and play in Connecticut and go and play here and play the West Coast Swing and be in the US 6-7 weeks in a row was something very different to the environment that I knew the last couple of years, in which I was performing quite well.
It's interesting because, you know, from the outside looking in, I look at the PGA Tour and there's obviously it's not just American golfers there now. There's a lot of European guys, and mm-hmm. there was then as well.
Yeah.
Yet the image I have from your time there was that you found it quite almost lonely or isolated.
Yeah, yeah, I was, except for the golf, I was bored. Absolutely bored. I've said this from day one. I mean, like, you play on the PGA Tour, you feel like you're playing for the Real Madrid. I mean, they treat you unbelievably well. I mean, it's wherever you want to go, whatever you want to do is yes for everything. You ask for one thing, they give you five. Yeah, it'll be there the next day. I mean, it's unbelievable. But coming from where I come from, I grew up downtown Brussels. I used to walk 100 yards and go to a fish shop or a butcher or a newsstand or have a coffee here or go to European style restaurants here and there, have endless choice of how you want to live your life. And I felt like in the US it was either going to Chipotle or Five Guys or watching basketball on TV and be in bed by 7 and by the side of a motorway in a pretty average hotel, and everybody was 7 hours ahead in Belgium, 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, nobody to talk to, and I had a hard time dealing with it. But the buzz of a PGA Tour event is enormous. So you see this huge thing that's loud and it's like overly well organized, and yet you feel pretty lonely. It's pretty bizarre.
Yeah. Did I hear that you were in your room, you got the shakes, and that's what?
No, I think the, I don't know if it's the first year or second year, I came back and played Wentworth, and I remember checking in my room at Runnymede and put the golf on, and it was, you know, Sky Golf, and it was golf in the US, and I pictured myself driving a courtesy car in the US on one of those big dual carriageway with fast food both sides, and I had the shakes. So I realized that if it was going physically, it wasn't going to head well.
So that was the moment?
No, that wasn't the moment. I kept going, I think, for another year. I think that was the first year. So I kept going for another year because I kept my card miraculously the first year. And then the next year, I remember in Houston, I was on the bench just outside the clubhouse talking to an Aussie caddy that if I stay here, I'm going to lose my mind. I'm going to get sick. Like really sick, like mentally sick. So I just have to go home.
Well, some people would stay, try and stick it out, I can do this. Was it an easy decision for you?
Well, it was, because it got that far. Either you're ultimately golfing driven machine and the only thing you see is PGA Tour and play for $7 million every week, or you are somebody that has a bit more taste in life, or that has a life outside of golf, or has just a different idea of life. I mean, don't get me wrong. I mean, I've met unbelievable people in my 2 years over there. I played golf at unbelievable places. I still have not feelings, but I still like to see a lot of guys that I've met over there. But to do it on a constant basis and see it and go there and experience it as a whole is something that was just too difficult for me to do.
And now you have a family life, so.
Yeah.
The chance of you ever going back to America on a full-time basis?
Who knows? Maybe I'm gonna be a different guy in 5 years and I'm gonna be okay with it, because I will have a solid family with my wife and maybe another kid, and then it would be different. I'm sure a lot of guys that move over there with their families and everything, I mean, they have that as an anchor that I'd never had when I was there.
It's interesting from the perspective is, as we're talking, you're like, actually, this has been some journey. It's sometimes hard, isn't it, when you've lived it yourself to realize, you know, where you've come and what you've done and how it's all panned out.
Yeah, when you go, you know, like we're doing now, step by step. I mean, yeah, there's a lot to talk about, and we're only just
scratching the surface.
Yeah, just talking about, you know, the biggest issues, shall we say. But sure. Like if it all ends tomorrow, I mean, I have no regrets whatsoever. Either being here or being over in the US or lived what I was, you know, able to live. I mean, there's not a lot of people that can say that have lived as much as I have.
Well, it's fair to say, I think Nicholas hasn't had a boring life, hasn't had a boring career as well. It's interesting, isn't it? Because, of course, we can all remember still, it's only weeks ago, Tiger Woods winning the Masters. And, you know, trajectory in people's careers, they don't just normally go on an upward curve. They don't have to be like Nicholas Kolsarts and sort of take huge dips and then take a big high, as we saw from Tiger. You know, you just never know what's around the corner when it comes to a sportsman's career. Never rule them out. You just don't know what's going on in their personal life necessarily to know why things are happening to them like they are on the golf course. And as Nicholas says there towards the end, who knows what's around the corner? He certainly still has the talent to maybe go on and achieve even more. But I've got to say, and I'm sure you agree, a really fascinating listen. And as always, love to hear what you have to make of it all. You can do so the usual ways. You can tweet us at The Round Podcast or get in contact on Facebook as well at The Round Golf Podcast. More great podcasts on The Round coming your way as well in the weeks to come. We look forward to you joining us then.
Thank you for listening to The Round with Richard Kaufman. You can follow us and get in touch via Twitter at The Round Podcast, on Instagram, Podcast The Round, and on Facebook at The Round Richard Kaufman. And we'd appreciate you taking the time to rate and review us on iTunes. The Round Podcast with Richard Kaufman, in association with IMG Audio.